You're back with Annie on 3CR Breakfast and in the studio live, which is my first live. You're my first live guest, Margaret. Can you hear me?
That's better.
Yeah, that's better.
That's okay.
Yeah, well, see, we're all settling in. Margaret Ryan, you've come to talk to us about the Papua New Guinea Highlands. Can you tell us a little bit about your connection to that community? Yeah.
Annie, first of all, thank you for having me and thanks, listeners. My situation is that I was up in Papua New Guinea as a young nurse many years ago. And needed to come back to Australia to do another project and always wanted to go back. Never happened. But now in retirement, it's given me a perfect opportunity to do as much as I can to work with Papua New Guinea and to befriend the people, you know, to really be part of it. And it's very topical at the moment because we are talking so much in Australia now about our relationship with the Pacific community. And, you know, Penny Wong is on Fiji at the moment. But people mightn't realise that so far as the Pacific community goes, Australia is by far the largest participant, member. We have something like, I think, 27 million now. The next largest is actually Papua New Guinea. It's not New Zealand. So Papua New Guinea is about 9 million people. New Zealand, I think, is about 6 or 7. And then the other two major nations are the Fiji and the Solomons. And then the others are quite a bit smaller. So in terms of our relationship with Papua New Guinea, it really matters. It's one thing to have diplomatic relationships. It's another thing to have AusAid. But probably in this day and age, what is really important is for us ordinary folk to know each other, you know, to be part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me, from your experience, I mean, you went there about 25 years ago and it obviously had a huge impact on you. What is that connection that you believe Australians should have with the women, mainly the women of the Highlands, right?
Yeah. Annie, it was life-changing for me, absolutely life-changing. And not only in terms of what I got to know about Papua New Guinea, but in terms of how getting out of Australia and looking back at Australia, how my relationship with Australia changed. So what it did for me and is that as a young person in Australia, you sometimes feel that you have to have a doctorate or you have to be tremendously experienced in a field to be able to make a contribution. I think what Papua New Guinea taught me about Australia is that oftentimes we have many people who have completed doctorates, who are very knowledgeable in areas, but oftentimes don't have the energy to actually do the work, to do the meeting the cause. And so when I came back to Australia, what I learned was, by all means, use those people to support you, to have the knowledge, to be able to guide you, who have the qualifications. But essentially, just do the work.
You mean hands-on?
Just do the work.
Yeah. What were the things that you perceived were the key needs of what were they asking? What did they want from you?
Okay. So as a young Australian, to go into there as I had done coronary care, intensive care, and midwifery, the whole lot, you know, and I got up there very suddenly, actually, because of a crisis after their independence with training younger people into the healthcare professions. And when
so
I got
you
up,
volunteered?
So when I got up there, I was swamped. All of a sudden, you've got dying babies, you've got dying children, dying mothers. I still sticks in my head the young mother where I palpated her and found Krebs, gas. She had gas gangrene. This young mother, pregnant, you know, and it's just something, kind of experiences that you can't believe until you go up there and see in those years. Now, things have moved a long way since. And that's the message that I would like to bring to Australia is how much they have developed in that time. They have their own now. They have their own doctors, nurses, you know, pilots, judges, teachers, whatever. They've got them now. But in those years, it was just devastating to see the terrible need. And even things like you go to do a dressing on a wound and all of a sudden there is no antiseptic. You know, you have to use boil water and salt. It's things that in Australia you couldn't imagine you have to deal with. But I loved it. I loved it because what I learned about the people is they love fun. They're so happy. You know, in all that poverty, they're so happy. And they're so good to each other and sharing what they have. And they're kind of, if you like, pure socialism that existed in those years because nobody had money, nobody had a bank account much. I remember the first time we had a nurse who was on a wage who had her things that she had acquired on the wage and were trying to take it down on an outrigger canoe back to her village. It was like something you'd never see. Nobody has that amount of stuff. They only have a little bag. Yeah, and she had a sewing machine and radio and all sorts of things to take back. So it was.
So you were really experiencing the covalence between what would be considered to be Western modernity and Highland life. They were meeting. Those two elements were meeting.
Yeah. It's kind of. Was this
a positive thing?
Yes. And essentially, that interestingly, Annie, is the subject of our talk. The one of the reasons why I wanted to come into the radio is because we are having this talk on June the 3rd, which is addressing that. It's looking at a traditional village and what happened when the mining came in, and how the people adjusted to that. Because when the helicopters came in, it meant they could go out. And so they were sending out their young people to go to college. And they were also learning the value of money and how the other tribes further up had already got on to wages, and they started to realize that the mining company was using them, coming in, taking them because they were cheaper than an alternate tribe up in the Highlands who had more experience. And just learning those things about themselves, it was very, very crucial time for them in these last 50 years. Has been a really important time. When I was up there early on, my first year, 1977, going out into the village, people would touch the white skin. I'd never felt it before. They would have one single radio that the head man in the village had, and he communicated with Port Moresby and gave it to everybody else. They didn't have, now they have access to mobile phones. Australia now owns the Digicel system in Papua New Guinea for mobile phones. Telstra bought it last year, so it now belongs to Australia, and so we can communicate much more effectively now. But So what we're trying to do now is look not at the historical connections that Australia has with Papua New Guinea. Many people go up and walk the Kokoda Track. Many people have relatives who were embroiled in that terrible war up there. Many of them don't realise, perhaps, that the whole north coast of Papua New Guinea was bombed. And so many Papua New Guineans lost their lives too, but there's no memorial to them. But we have this certainly
so
notion.
So what you're saying is that Australia has a very Western colonial approach to this relationship with Papua New Guinea, and it was about time that we fronted up to a much more equal understanding.
Reciprocal, yes. We need to look at the
especially since it's an exploitative relationship.
Yes, that's right. We had Octeti, you know, that was BHP and many other in the consortium, but they took the minerals and then polluted the Fly River and then handed it over to the government to have the residue of the mine in lieu of not paying conversation. So, yeah, there's a lot we have to think about. People also have – some Australians were born up there because their parents were part of the government administration, and they have –
In fact, I've met people.
Yes, you know, their tie is very strong because where you're born matters enormously. So there are Australians who find Papua New Guinea very endearing. It's very part of them for that reason, yeah. So – but those are historical ties. And it's for us now to look and say, in this second millennium, what is our relationship with Papua New Guinea, given that we are together forever? We're 100 kilometres from each other or even less, and we are forever together. So how do we shape that relationship going into these next 50, 100 years? What does it mean to us? For people in Papua New Guinea, English, in the ordinary folk in New Guinea, English is the third language. The first language is the talk place, is the dialect of that area, and some of those take quite a large area, whether it's the Melpa or the Enga language or whatever. And then there's a second talk pidgin, which is now the national communication. And then English. Now, whilst people going through secondary school learn English, they don't retain it because nobody cracks a joke in English up there, you know? It's
a bureaucratic language.
Yeah, yeah. I learned French at school. I don't remember any French. I went over there and tried to buy a postcard in Paris, couldn't remember a word. And it's like that. And so for us to develop friendships and to communicate in English would actually be very helpful to the secondary school students. And things we can do together as friends that would change the relationship widely and permanently if we could do these things. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And so this talk is actually called Changing Social Relations in Remote Papua New Guinea.
Yeah,
and it's by the talker is Monica Mingirel.
Yes, yes.
Yeah,
Dr. Monica Mingirel. She did her PhD on Papua New Guinea. She's an associate professor at Melbourne University Anthropology Department, and she is going to speak on her work. And then that's going to be followed up in 2 months later by a talk ABC journalist, Hilda Wayne, who is from the Highlands, Papua New Guinea, and she is up there at the moment. And she is going to speak on contemporary Papua New Guinean situation. Hilda does a radio national broadcast to the Pacific women.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and so that will be a second one. And what we're trying to do is develop these talks, dialogues, because the Papua New Guinea One Talks Association are coming to the first talk as well. So we will have dialogue around Monica's work and then the Papua New Guinean contemporary response to that.
Is this sort of similar to the Timor-Leste connections that people have in community in Australia, that people go to Timor-Leste and contribute time and effort and they have Correct. A constant friendship? And it's rural Australia, people from around yes. Australia, yes. and they do things like save money to buy a buffalo. I mean, it's their context. It's Timor-Leste. This is what you're trying to develop.
That's exactly right. That's exactly
right. A friendship bond.
Yes, yeah. Because Queensland has a relationship with Papua New Guinea that is much stronger than New South or Victoria. But we have such resources here in Victoria that, you know, we have.
It's about time we stood up.
Oh, yeah, we can do much more here. Yeah, yeah. And so the talk is on June the 3rd. It's at 7 o'clock at night, Friday, June the 3rd, 7 o'clock at night at 617 Nicholson Street, North Carlton, which is three doors from the corner of Richardson and Nicholson Street. And it's on the tram number 96. It's stop 17. And it's free of charge, and everyone is welcome. We're not expecting a huge crowd, so we'll be COVID socially distanced, because it's large enough for that, and promise a good night. It's just an hour with the supper and nibbles and things, but we would love people to come along and be part of that if they're interested.
You're lighting the flame, aren't you? You're lighting the flame for friendship.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'll put all that information up on the podcast so people can check. And thank you very much for coming in. It's very interesting.
Thank you.
In fact, I think I might come and record you.
Thanks, Annie. Thank you very much. And thanks, listeners. Good.